From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. You have to admit we're pretty lucky. Nowadays, we take it for granted that fish sauce, coconut milk, and lemongrass can be found in grocery stores all over LA. But it was a different story before 1972, the year that Bangkok Market opened its doors on Melrose Avenue. Bangkok Market was the first Thai market in the U.S., and for 47 years, it was known as a go-to for fresh Asian produce and staples of the Thai pantry. Whatever you needed, they probably sold it. But now, that era has come to an end.
I've lived it, which means I've been 1,000 miles an hour.
That's Jet Tila, celebrity chef who you've probably seen on the Food Network. His parents were the couple that opened Bangkok Market in 1972. Last week, his mother announced she was retiring and permanently closing the market. I wanted to get some backstory about the history of the market and how it influenced our city's landscape. Hi.
I should have been here before. I apologize.
No, it's
okay. Let me open up by saying
I understand.
I was honoring the wishes of my mom, and, you know, she wanted to keep it kind of quiet.
I don't blame her.
You know what I mean.
The endings are very hard, and they're very emotional.
Endings are very weird, right? Like, because if we created an invite or kind of spread the word, then it becomes its own monster.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I think that the family has probably thought about closing for what, 10 years?
Oh, more than that, Evan, you know, because we're family, like 20 years,
yeah,
right?
I understand. And so all of that. And then the minute you make the decision, what is that feeling?
Oh, my God.
Relief.
It's relief. It is 1,000 pounds off your back. It's 1,000 pounds off your son's back because, you know, I've always been behind the scenes for the last 20 years, man, like business coaching, dealing with their paperwork, dealing with government, dealing with taxes, dealing with lawyers, because you have two kids that were 18 and like 22, you know, opening a grocery store, having no idea.
That's how old they were?
Yeah, I think it was 24. I mean, 24, 22. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's so crazy. So let's jump into some history. When we say it was the first Thai grocery store in Los Angeles, was it the first Thai grocery store in America?
It's actually in America. We know that for a fact. In 1972, the Bangkok Market opened across the street from where it closed, by the way. It wasn't the original 4757 Melrose. It was 4800 if you want to get into the minutiae. But yes, 600 square feet was the original little trading post, and it was the first in America for sure.
When your parents first emigrated,
yeah,
from Thailand, did they know what they were going to do, or did they just arrive? And were they the first of the family to arrive?
Yes, 1966 was the big year that a lot of the Thai people came. I think it had to do with Vietnam and visas being readily available to Thais. They came here separately. They did not know each other. And it was not the plan. My dad was, you know, my dad made trouble in Thailand. I mean, to be very frank, you know, he got into a lot of trouble. And the reason why he came to America was because he was going to have to leave Bangkok or end up in jail. This is open, not Thai history. Now it's American, Thai American history because of this. But my mom came. She was more of a middle class kid. Her father was an engineer. And they met here. My grandfather from my mom's side scraped together 20,000 bucks.
That is a lot of money.
It's huge money. Imagine your new son-in-law is like, let me gamble this and open a grocery store.
And was it because the ladies were saying, we need this stuff to cook?
You know, yes. It was because cooks were going to Chinatown and they were getting similar ingredients and not the same. And my father, knowing it was a very provincial at that time. Like if Evan Kleiman was coming from Bangkok, my dad would ask Evan to bring a case of coconut milk with your luggage. And it was a trading post, the hub of Thai gathering, the original Bangkok Market. And it was just a home for Thai people in LA.
Had the temple opened yet?
No, temple was 84.
Wow.
This is 72. Right. And, you know, my dad would being like the community head, the vivid things that I would remember were like there were Thai people who passed away with no money and they would build coffins like in the back of the store, like with not literally pallet like planks, but It was just the one place you could hang out with everyone else that was where you were from, and you felt safe, and you had community.
So growing up as a kid, once you started to have some agency in decision-making ability, were you constantly chafing at the expectation that you would be at the beck and call of the store?
Oh my God, we lived there, right? We're tethered. My father and mother loved it because they were the heads of community. I was this kid who was just drug along. And I was raised in that grocery store. Right, yeah.
And I think I read on Twitter that Jazz from Chitlada says she remembered you as a kid making deliveries.
God. Yeah. So I worked every single position in that grocery store, from like cleaning bathrooms to stocking shelves, bagging groceries. And then, of course, I would ride on the trucks to drop off food. Anyone in the city from Jazz to Sang-Yoon to Suzanne Tract and Preach, I first started helping deliveries, and then I was running deliveries. I drove the van, I drove the bobtails, I drove the forklifts, yeah.
So did you want to run away from the cooking world, from the restaurant world?
Oh, I hated food. I mean, let's be real, right? Like, imagine growing up, being forced, because there was no childcare. Bangkok Market was my childcare before preschool. And then post school, it was after school care, right? I wanted nothing to do with the Bangkok Market or the Royal Thais. Eventually, they opened 7 restaurants, the Bangkok Produce, the Bangkok Import. Like,
it was like tentacles.
It was tentacles. It was more like chains, actually. It was literally like it was prisoner chains, feet, hands, belly chains, the whole deal. But man, I wanted to curse right there, but if it were not for those thousands of hours about knowing food and loading SKUs and like checking groceries and doing restaurant deliveries and learning, I learned 5,000 SKUs by the time I was 10 years old, 15 years old.
So SKUs are the unique numbers that are associated with individual products that you find in a grocery store.
Yeah, I guess I should say, right, I knew every brand of fish sauce that existed, curry paste, shrimp paste, coconut milk. I was an expert. I did my 10,000 hours in food probably by 12 or 15, my first 10,000 hours.
So when did you submit? When did you say, oh, just forget it. I know I have to do this. So I'm just going to go to school, or I'm just going to start apprenticing.
Submit meaning to, there's different types of submission, I guess.
To the career.
Okay. Yeah. I submitted when I was, I think, 22. I just was bumming around SMC. Right, for the third year, right, with maybe 8 credits under my belt, engine rebuild, and I don't know, it was, and I was like, I need money. I need to make money. So I started teaching cooking classes out of my mom's backyard, but all of my initial guest customers came from the Bangkok Market, and I had little signs I typed up on Word, Thai cooking classes, $39, 3 courses. Come to my house, my mom's house. And it was all because of the store, our initial group of, and they're out there in LA, they're listening right now. They know who they are. I called them the originals. And it was because of the store. So that's when I submitted. And because of those Bangkok Market cooking classes, Barbara Hansen wrote an article in the LA Times, front page story. I was 22 years old. And that propelled me, that actually pushed me, gave me the inspiration to go to culinary school and formalize or speak another food language, right? Learn French food. And because of Bangkok Market, because of Barbara Hansen, because of all this, I am here today. I mean, it's a long, boring story, but it is my origin. I lived a piece of LA food history.
So amazing. So was there competition? I would imagine that, like many self-referential communities, that as it grows, then there start to be competition, right?
Yes. In the 90s, everyone knows LAXC, L-A-X-C. But before LAXC was in downtown, Andy, who was the owner, who is the owner currently, opened Thailand Plaza. So Bang Luck coexisted with Bangkok Market. So if you know Bang Luck Market, there's one in North Hollywood by the Thai Temple, and there's one on Hollywood Boulevard, right, in Thai Town. So they coexisted for, you know, since the 80s, but here came the behemoth. Here came the big guy, right? So they opened this giant Thailand Plaza, and then they opened LAXC, and we were like, oh, man, they're going to be put out of business, you know? And But it all worked out. I think Bangkok market was started as a Thai market, then it became a Salvadorian market, because, and then it became a Filipino market. And then, you know, then it, we were the only people to have like a lot of Indian products. So we survived by evolving. And I was lucky to learn more SKUs, you know, Filipino SKUs and, you know, Mexican Salvadorian SKUs and Indonesian SKUs. It was pretty awesome.
So your mom.
Yeah.
She gets to put her feet up.
My mom is officially retired as of November 19th, 18th.
But she's not going to be able to. What does that mean? Does that mean she's just going to become a full-time
grandmother?
Grandmother?
Yeah, she's a part-time grandmother now. And no, like, I'm, you know, I've got a lot of other ventures going on. She's like, hey, Jay, you need to find me a new job now in my retirement. And she's like, I'm a cashier. I'll, I don't know, input, you know, data crunch numbers. I'm like, no, you're not. Like, you got it. She's volunteering at the Thai temple now a lot. So, yeah, no, she's in a weird place. Like, to be frank, I think it's exciting and it's a relief to know you're retiring, and then it happens.
And it's going to take her about a year.
I feel that, right?
Yeah, it takes about a year to just, for the PTSD.
Yeah, you're not kidding.
To subside.
They ran that store for what, like 48 years?
Yeah.
And one day. She doesn't have a store to go to. It might take longer than that.
You've had such a different path.
Yeah, let's talk
about it. Than a lot of the chefs that we've talked about over the 20-something years of this show.
Sum it up for me.
Because you were this kid who was imbued with the market, and because you didn't do a series of stages that were at high-end or recognizable name places because you were doing those cooking classes in your backyard. Initially, your career path seemed more humble, but now you're the winner.
That's interesting. So weird. Am I really the winner?
Well,
I
no,
think yes.
I mean,
they gave me all the tools.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Unintentionally. I guess they gave me the tools.
Yeah.
Those thousands of hours of being miserable in markets and restaurants and farms and warehouses.
Yeah. You have multiple 10,000 hours
there you
behind
go.
You.
I don't know, Evan, because you know what? Because you knew me. We've known each other since I was literally, what, 22?
Yeah.
And it feels weird to sit here and we talk about all these projects because you're always my friend and mentor. Does that make sense? Like, I've learned.
Which is hilarious. I mean, because, you know, I'm like a friend of mine says, I'm aggressively passive when it comes to pursuing my own career. And then you're like catapulted from a rocket ship. Well, thank you so much, Jet.
Oh, thank you, Evan. Thank you very much.
That's Chef Jet Tila. We've been talking about the history of his family's Bangkok market, which closed last month after 47 years.
There were a number of reasons why Thais opened restaurants. It was economically viable, and that's how Americans kind of knew Thai people.
A couple of years ago, we took a look at the immigration stories of Thai business owners, like Jet's parents. I spoke with Professor Mark Padungpat about how Thai food made its way to Los Angeles. He's the author of a book called Flavors of Empire that I can't recommend enough. I thought you might like to hear it again. What's your relationship to LA? Why did you choose to write your book about Thai food sort of centered in LA?
Thank you for that question. I was born and raised in Los Angeles. My parents immigrated from Thailand in the 1970s, and I actually grew up in Pacoima, in the working class suburb of Pacoima in the East San Fernando Valley, mostly working class Latino immigrants, majority Mexican, some Guatemalans, some El Salvadorians. I lived a 5-minute drive away from the Thai temple, the Wat Thai of Los Angeles in North Hollywood. And so I grew up Thai American among other immigrant populations. And food for me, you know, I've always kind of had an ambivalent relationship to food. The funny thing is I didn't even want to write a book about food. I felt like, for one, I was always being defined by food. When I would meet people and they would discover that I was Thai, you know, one of the first things I would get is, oh, I love pad Thai. And that was the only way they kind of knew of Thai people. But I felt like we were also just kind of invisible everywhere else. And, you know, the other reason I decided to write about food is because I really felt like, you know, especially once I got to college at the University of Oregon, felt like food had become a stand-in for Thai people.
That's so fascinating because we hear over and over again how food is this window into cultures. And in your experience, what you're saying is that it basically erased. It erased you. So fascinating. So let's go back kind of historically. In your book, you talk about how America's love affair with Thai cuisine actually began during the Cold War.
Correct. You know, typically when we think about Asian immigrant food cultures in the United States, it's when that particular group steps foot on U.S. soil. But I thought it was really important to kind of pull back and look at the role that the United States played in Southeast Asia immediately after World War II. You know, the United States, fearing the spread of communism in Asia and Southeast Asia, particularly Vietnam, the United States really intervenes heavily in Thailand from the late 1950s to the early 1970s, right after the Vietnam War. And part of what they wanted to do is just establish a strategic base in Thailand, establish military bases to, you know, try to thwart off the communist influence in the area. And what the United States tried to do after World War II was really win hearts and minds around the world. So they viewed Asia and Asian peoples and cultures more positively than they had before, right? We were just coming out of a World War II with internment of Japanese Americans. But immediately afterwards, because of foreign policy objectives, the United States starts to imagine Asia and the Pacific as, you know, people who could potentially be Americans if they were just guided and modernized and developed. And so the United States establishes cultural exchange programs in Thailand. The Southeast Asian Treaty Organization headquarters is established in Bangkok. There's a number of programs, the U.S. Peace Corps, the Fulbright, private organizations teaching English get established in Thailand. So all of these relationships and connections and policies lead to everyday interactions between what I, you know, call kind of ordinary U.S. citizens, people who aren't diplomats or state officials or military officials, but just everyday people who are traveling to Thailand. And that's where they discover Thai food for the first time.
So this is so interesting. So amongst all of these organized exchange programs were culinary tours.
Yes, yes.
So you're saying that basically regular American people got sort of seduced to Thai culture through culinary tours, and they jump-started the knowledge of Thai food in America before there was even Thai immigration?
Yes, that's correct. I'll give you a specific example. So Marie Wilson was the first to publish a Thai cookbook in the United States. In 1965, she publishes a book called Siamese Cookery. And Siamese was the name used to refer to Thai people. You know, Thailand was formerly known as Siam before the 1930s when they changed the name to Thailand. And so she writes the first Thai cookbook in the United States and publishes it in 1965. And because of the 1965 Immigration Act, this is right at that same time, from 1924 to 1965, Thais couldn't enter the United States because of U.S. immigration policies. And so there weren't a lot of Thais, and the Thais who were in the United States were largely students who had the wherewithal and to come and study in the United States. And so women like Marie Wilson, there's Jennifer Brennan, Maida Khroizat, they're traveling in Thailand during the 50s and 60s because of this relationship the United States has with Thailand. They collect recipes, they bring those recipes home, sometimes publish them in cookbooks. You know,
and this is before the opening of like the famed LA market, Bangkok market.
Yes, yes.
So these recipes were bastardized.
You can say that. I think I was less interested in whether or not the food that they were making was authentic, because I understood that they didn't have the ingredients available to them in Los Angeles. And so they really had to, you know, be somewhat creative, sometimes missing the mark. And I think Marie Wilson, one of her recipes for gang kung shrimp curry, it's a red curry that uses curry paste and also coconut milk as its base. I think she used sour cream and cayenne pepper to try to replicate this flavor.
So you say that this kind of culinary tourism created an idealized portrait of mm-hmm. Thai people and Thailand in the American imagination.
Yes. I like to think about it as a Disney-fied version, in the sense that, you know, in order to make their cookbooks and to make Thai food and to open up these more positive kind of relationships to Thai people and Thai culture. You know, suburban women like Marie Wilson, they painted a very romanticized image of Thailand as this kind of exotic kingdom where different kinds of people, so they acknowledged that Thailand had different kind of people, Chinese, Indians, groups from different religious backgrounds, and they framed and painted a picture of Thai people as living kind of harmoniously together despite their differences, and that Thai food, because it borrowed from all of these different cultural influences, really reflected that Thailand was a country that brought together diverse groups of people harmoniously. And it just wasn't the case, because there had been virulent anti-Chinese sentiment in Thailand in the 30s that extended into the 50s.
Also, I think one has to mention the giant musical, The King and I, which was most Americans' sort of entree into the fact that there was this land. So let's come closer to today. Let's talk about Thai immigration to L.A. When did Thais begin arriving in L.A. in numbers? What were some of the reasons for coming?
Thais start coming in large numbers in the mid-1960s, and the first wave is made up mostly of Thai students who were from, you know, middle-class backgrounds from urban areas, specifically Bangkok. So Thai students were coming. They were coming on student visas, right? Coming to study in the United States. And then by the late 1970s, they started overstaying those visas.
So here in LA, there's this huge Thai restaurant boom that starts in the 1970s and in the 1980s, especially on the city's west side. In 1975, one-third of all Thai businesses in L.A. were restaurants. So what factors steered these immigrants who came or overstayed their visas into the restaurant business?
It was just one of the more viable economic opportunities open to them. They didn't have language skills. You know, there's a range of reasons, both structural and individual. But I think one key factor here as well is that there was a group of Thais who had already made some headway in the food industry in Los Angeles, opening up restaurants. And they then kind of reached out to other Thais who came over and immigrated and then helped them open up restaurants as well.
Your book also talks about how Thai Americans attempt to build a really robust community, including the establishment of Thai Town. What kind of challenges did they face initially on creating these aspects of community that are now so deeply embedded?
You know, Thai Town is in an urban area. They had a much easier time appealing to city officials to kind of get the neighborhood between, you know, Hollywood Boulevard, between Western and Normandy, marked off as Thai Town. But in the suburbs in the 1980s, Thais had a really difficult time, mainly because, you know, when Thai immigrants moved next to the Thai temple and had food festivals to build community and use it as a community space, their idea of living in the suburbs was that the home wasn't the center of suburban life. It was the temple. But for residents in that neighborhood, you know, they held on to that idea of 1950s suburban ideal, where the home was the center of life. Tree-lined streets, plentiful parking, quiet neighborhoods. Thai immigrants living there and trying to build community around food festivals, that vision of suburban life clashed with the existing visions. So they had to deal with specifically zoning laws.
That was Mark Padungpot, Associate Professor of Asian and Asian American Studies at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. I spoke with him in 2017 about his book called Flavors of Empire, Food and the Making of Thai America. Coming up, Patricia Escarcega of the LA Times and a rundown of the year's best cookbooks with our friend Celia Sack of Omnivore Books. Some great gift ideas are on the way. Stick around.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. It's that time of the show where we take a trip somewhere in Southern California for great food. Guiding us today is Patricia Escarcega, restaurant critic of the LA Times. This place, I read your comments about it, not in the regular place in a review, but through your newsletter.
That's right. So my co-critic and I, Bill Addison, every week we send out a newsletter called Tasty Notes. And it's really a great opportunity for us to talk about the food we're eating outside of the restaurant reviews we file every week. And a couple of weeks ago, I wrote about Hawkins House of Burgers, which I discovered, you know, by just reading, I think, an old article in the LA Weekly. And then I looked them up on Instagram and I saw the burgers. And Evan, let me tell you, I immediately planned a trip to Watts to sink my teeth into those massive burgers.
Well, I can't believe that your first encounter was the Leaning Tower of Watts, which is legendary. Describe what makes up the Leaning Tower of Watts in a hamburger sense.
Yes, let me give you the laundry list of ingredients, if I may. So there's three ground beef patties, there's pastrami, there's bacon, there's a couple of fried eggs, there's a lot of melted cheddar cheese in there, there's red onions, there's lettuce, tomato, and then you have some really nice crispy onion rings pinned to the top. And don't forget, there's also a chicken wing on top of that. And it's somehow, it's architecturally sound. It doesn't fall apart. There's a spear running through it, a stick, I should say, you know, to hold it up. But I was kind of amazed by how well it holds up.
And then I would imagine you attacked it layer by layer.
Yes. So the method of attack here is you obviously can't take a solid bite out of this beauty. So you have to kind of slice at it. if you've ever seen an al pastor trompo in a taco truck, you kind of just slice along the edges there, scrape at it, if you will. It's honestly one of the best burgers I've had in Los Angeles. I love their beef patties, these thick half-pound beef patties. They cook them over charcoal, so they have that like beautiful, you know, smoky summer barbecue. It really evokes those childhood memories if you grew up eating that kind of food, which I did. It really does taste freshly just plucked off the grill. It's so good.
When one reads about a burger like this, one tends to think of it as just like a novelty item.
That's right. Obviously, it's a fun item. You get looks when you order it. I think I walked it out of the dining room. And we should talk a little bit about the actual business. It's inside a historic market that's been in operation since 1939. It's this really plain-looking building on Imperial Highway. It was started by James Henry Hawkins, who came to Los Angeles as part of the great African-American migration of that era. And it stayed in the family. It started as a market. His daughter added the burger restaurant in the 1980s, and that was Cynthia Hawkins. And today, Cynthia still runs it with her daughters. You can stop by, say hi to them. They're an amazing family. They call the restaurant a community restaurant. I believe the last time there was a teacher strike, they fed all the teachers. They are part of a lot of food drives. It's really one of those great Los Angeles restaurants that I think doesn't often show up on those kind of classic LA restaurant roundups, but it probably ought to.
That was Patricia Escarcega talking about the Hawkins House of Burgers in Watts. You can read about Patricia's eating adventures in the LA Times food newsletter. You can subscribe at latimes.com/food.
There are so many this year, and more that I've ever wanted to take home with me.
That's Celia Sack, owner of Omnivore Books in San Francisco. Each year, she calls in with a list of her favorite books of the year. Here they are, just in time for your gift buying. Last year, when we spoke, Filipino food was just all the rage in the cookbook world.
Yes.
Has there been a really big category over the last 12 months?
Yeah, there have actually been two. And I'm not going to say a huge category, but I was thinking about it this morning, and there are a couple things that stand out. One is Israel. You know, the Middle East is still really something that people are fascinated by. And Israel seems to be sort of locus of cooking where all the different influences from the Middle East come together. So everybody seems really excited about that kind of food. Of course, Ottolenghi introduced us to that several years ago. And with Sami Tamimi, his partner, writing about Palestinian food, you know, the two influences came in there. And then when Michael Solomonov started writing about his restaurant, Zahav, in Philadelphia, that continued the trend. Well, this year there was Sababa by Adina Sussman, who focused on the Carmel market in Israel. And then Admoni, who wrote Shuk, she owns Balabusta in New York City. And both of those are just really focused on the food of Israel, not specific to any country around it. And then there were several interesting Jewish cookbooks as well, including Leah Koenig's Jewish cookbook, which came out around the same time. All three of those came out in September. There's also some Palestinian stuff. Zaytoun by Yasmin Khan is really wonderful. It came out this year. And then Sami Tamimi has his own Palestinian cookbook coming out in the spring, which I'm excited about.
Yeah, me too.
The other category of cookbooks that's been so popular this year is Mexico. People are really getting interested in not just regional, but in Mexico City cooking, which actually brings in all the different regions of Mexico. So there's Made in Mexico by Danny Mina. He's got a restaurant called Echo and Dumbo in New York City. And his book, one thing that I really love about it is he's got different recipes from different chefs around Mexico City. And then in the back, he's got a map that shows where all of their restaurants are. So it's kind of a guide as well. And then our local heroine, Gabriela Camara, who owns Kala in San Francisco and also the very renowned Contramar in Mexico City, had a book come out this spring called My Mexico City Kitchen. And that's an absolutely beautiful love story to her home city. So both of those are really delicious tours of Mexico City. And then a great book just came out called Oaxaca by Bricia Lopez, who has a restaurant in Los Angeles. And that's all about the cooking of Oaxaca, which of course is replete with moles and all the wonderful crickets and different cuisines of Oaxaca that make it special.
But all these books are great. It's like, you know, I'm trying to say to myself, Evan, okay, you can pick one.
Yeah, exactly. I know. And I very, very rarely take books home from the store because I have such little space. And yet there were a number of them that I just had to have this year. One of my favorites that I took home is called Apple, Recipes from the Orchard from James Rich. He's from Somerset, England, and his family owns a cider orchard there and business. And his book, we have some great apple trees up in our weekend home in the town of Tamales. One is very sweet and one is Pink Lady, so it's really tart and great for baking. And his book calls for using any kind of apples. I mean, he's got sweet category and bitter and tart and every kind. And you can make everything from cider to apple butter to, pork marinated in apples and mustard. And I mean, just some wonderful, wonderful dishes. I've been cooking from that a ton.
Yeah, we love that book down here. So has there been a book like, you know, in the past, Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, or, you know, Jerusalem, books that you just, one single book that is really hard to keep in stock this year, or is it more overall?
There is one, and it's called Nothing Fancy by Alison Roman. She has just gotten to be such a huge star in the cooking world, and it's really fun to see her rise. From her first book was called Dining In, and that in itself was really popular. But then she also started writing for the New York Times, and she's gotten a lot of press. And Nothing Fancy has just hit this spot, sort of like Jerusalem, where everybody is turning themselves into pretzels trying to figure out what it is about this book that makes it so special. So, of course, I had to take it home and cook a couple of dishes from it to see for myself. Oh, it's so good. A customer of mine said the perfect thing. She said, it's food you know how to cook, but different. It's just got something more to it. So even though it's called Nothing Fancy and it's supposed to be larger plates that you can share, it really doesn't have to be. It's just as good. I didn't even actually realize that until she gave a talk at our shop. It just seems like food you can make for any dinner. there was something she had that was a roasted radishes. So you take the whole radish, including the leaves, and you put a little olive oil on it and put it and salt and put it in the oven to roast it. Meanwhile, you make something called a green goddess butter, which has the same ingredients as green goddess dressing. You've got anchovies and chili pepper flakes and parsley and everything that goes into that with a stick of butter. Put that in the Cuisinart, make it into a butter, and then spread that all over the plate, and then you serve the radishes on top of it. And it was so delicious and just flavors I wouldn't have thought of. I may have in some world thought to put a green goddess dressing on it, but I never would have thought to make that butter. And then I used the butter the next day when I had a roast chicken with potatoes and put some of that with that. And it was fantastic.
Now we're going to do a speed round, okay?
Okay, I'm ready.
So give me the title to the gift that would be for the baker.
For the baker. Okay, for the baker who likes bread, I would go for Poilain by Apollonia Poilain. Poilain is one of the most famous bread bakeries in Paris and has been there for many, many years. The owners of the renowned place died, sadly, in a plane accident a number of years ago, and their daughter Apollonia took over. She had been in college at Harvard and came back, took over many years ago, and now is in charge, and this is their first book in English. It's absolutely wonderful. I would say for, if you like sweet as well as savory, I would go for the new revised edition of Tartine. You know, over all the years that they've been in business, their recipes have changed slightly. So even their most famous items like their croissants have evolved in the recipe. So it's a good idea to get the new revised edition of that.
Okay, bartender.
Bartender, okay. There are a couple of them. There's Last Call. That's by Brad Thomas Parsons. It's sort of a roundup of all these bartenders around the country and what they would want their last drink to be. So it's a nice profile of them and of their drinks. Another one that I think is really inspiring is Christian Rohlich's Bar Chef. He is the head of the bar at Luke in Los Angeles for Suzanne Goen. And his recipes are really inventive and fun, but not so out there that you don't want to do them.
Now, barbecue and meat enthusiast.
You know, Aaron Franklin is wonderful. He owns Franklin Barbecue down in Austin, Texas, and he came out with a barbecue book a few years ago that is really sort of a Bible for grilling enthusiasts. The majority of the book is about how to smoke and build your own oven and things like that. And he has a new book called Franklin Steak, and it's got really interesting ideas and new thoughts about how to handle steak and different cuts of meat.
What about for the vegan?
Okay, for the vegan, I'm going to go with vegan and vegetarian because those are two categories that can sort of be melded into one. I love this one called Love and Lemons Every Day, and it's got lots of vegan recipes as well as vegetarian. And they're inventive. They're really, really nice. Another one I love is the Forest Feast Mediterranean that came out this year. And she's wonderful because she does these sort of illustrations that show you how everything gets put together. So it's really fun for kids as well as for grown-ups to cook from.
The killer home cook looking for a real challenge.
Okay. So Food of Sichuan by Fuchsia Dunlop. She wrote this book many years ago, but did a revised edition of it this year, and it's absolutely stunning. It's got some new recipes, and as well as the old ones that are still standing the test of time. It's really a challenge because there's so many textures that we're unused to, not just flavors. It's not just about being spicy, but it's also about new and exciting textures. Also, I would say Cooking in Iran, the Najmieh Batmanglij book. She is sort of the Julia Child of Iranian cooking, and this book is enormous and gorgeous and regional within Iran, which is really, really interesting. It goes from the mountain to the sea to the valleys, and everything in it is just fantastic.
The food history buff.
food history buff. There were so many great food history books this year. Paul Friedman came out with one on American cuisine that's really interesting, talking a lot about sort of processed foods and how we got here from the Civil War era to the current day. And there's also a really interesting one called Lost Feast that is all about foods that we used to eat and used to be available here but have sort of gone extinct, like carrier pigeons that were hunted to extinction because everybody loved the flavor so much. So we'll never get to know what those are like.
The devoted eater who doesn't want to turn on the stove or lift a finger.
Oh, wow. I know. How about Peter Reinhardt's Perfect Pan Pizza? Really easy. I mean, you do have to turn on the oven, it's true. But it makes making pizza so fun and easy. If you're afraid of it, like I am, if you've got a pizza stone that's been sitting in your closet gathering dust like mine has, Perfect Pan Pizza is the perfect book.
We're having this conversation earlier in the year than we usually do. Is there something that you're looking forward to seeing that will drop before the end of the year, but we haven't had a chance to see yet?
Yep, there are two books. One is Jubilee by Toni Tipton Martin. She is a really important scholar of African-American cooking and wrote a great bibliography last year about it called The Jemima Code. And this year, Jubilee is just coming out now, and it's all about African-American cooking from historical recipes, and she makes them new and updated in her book, but they include so much historical fact and citations. So that's a really wonderful one. And then we've had a really great crop this year of revised editions. I mentioned Tartine and also Food of Sichuan, but The Joy of Cooking is being revised. It's the great grandson of the author and his partner are redoing the book, and everyone's really, really excited about it. It includes things like sous vide cooking, and, you know, people were really mad when the last revision came out of it and it had so much less fat and less fun in it. And I think this puts the fun back into it.
In addition to being a cookbook store that is constantly giving us what's new, you also have a vintage book business that tortures me personally.
I try.
Tell us a bit about the 1952 holiday candy book that I saw on the Instagram feed.
Oh, God, yes, and sold really quickly, though I think I have a bead on another one that I think I'm going to get. So there were several holiday fun books that came in this year, antiquarian ones. There are holiday candy ones. There's holiday cocktails. Peter Popper Press did a number of them. They were in business in the 1950s and early 60s. And just have these really charming woodcut illustrations. And one thing I love about those books is that they can have a dust jacket or not, because the same design is on the boards. So oftentimes in those days, people threw out the dust jacket, and they're still fun either way. But the Holiday Candy Book, 1952, features just sort of all the popular American candies at the time. You know, they're especially hard candies, mints and lollipops and just, you know, fun taffy and things like that. And I don't know, it's just, it's such a fun stocking stuffer. I love books like that.
Well, thank you so much, Celia. As always, it's a pleasure.
Same. I always look forward to it.
That's Celia Sack, owner of Omnivore Books in San Francisco. We'll have a list of her favorite books on the Good Food website. That's kcrw.com/goodfood. Here in L.A., we're lucky to have a great cookbook store of our own. It's called Now Serving L.A. After the break, I'm talking to owner Ken Concepcion to get some more gift ideas for the food lover in your life. That's when Good Food continues. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. Cookbook stores are somewhat of a dying breed, but here in Los Angeles, we're lucky to have one in Now Serving LA, the only one of its kind in the city. Now Serving is a cozy store on the first floor of Chinatown's Far East Plaza. If you've never been, I highly recommend that you remedy that. The store sells a lot more than books, and today I wanted to get some gift recommendations. For that, I'm joined by Ken Concepcion, who owns the store with his wife, Michelle Mungal. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Evan.
I just have to say that your selection is always so tasty. Everything is beautifully made and beautifully picked. Give us an idea of what, in your mind, would be some really good gift ideas.
You know, you said tasty. We have some non-perishable food items here at the shop. We just got in these really unique Red Boat fish salt caramels that Red Boat is doing with Little Flower in Pasadena. They're sweet, they're tart, and then just a little bit of that umami funk, which is great.
Did I hear that you had some diaspora spices?
Yes, we carry the diaspora turmeric, which is phenomenal. You know, with diaspora, there's no middleman really. It goes straight from the farmers, gets packaged by diaspora, and then to us. The percentage of what the farmer gets through diaspora is 2 or 3 times as much as they would usually get from the importer, the exporter, the packager, and all that stuff. So it's really great.
Yeah, they're also really high quality.
Continuing on the path of the perishables, probably one of our most favorite things that everybody loves is the Flyby Jing Sichuan Chili Crisp. It's kind of like one of the mother sauces of Sichuan cuisine as a topping, and you can incorporate it in anything like a vinaigrette or a sauce, but you can put it on top of anything like scrambled eggs, you know, leftover pizza to a nicely poached piece of fish to, you know, some people even put it on ice cream.
I have, in fact, myself used it on leftover pizza.
Me too.
And what about non-consumables?
Something that we're really proud of. We have these beautiful hand-forged carbon steel pans from Virginia. The maker is Blank Creatives, and they're just gorgeous. They're fully seasoned, and they're a conversation statement piece in any kitchen.
What I love about them is the shape is very different from other sort of artisanal forged stuff that you're seeing these days. Could you describe a couple of the shapes?
Certainly. They have 3 shapes. There's a roaster. The roaster shape has a handle on each side, which is great for presentation for either like a whole chicken. There's the skillet, which is pretty straightforward, great for making eggs and sauteing anything. And there's 3 sizes within the skillet size, from large to small, to like a 9-inch skillet. And then there is the saucier, which has a large curved wall to catch any juices. That's also really great from oven to table as well.
That's the one I lust after. Kind of like a hybrid between a wok and a sauteuse.
Right, yes. Yeah, I love that old French word sauteuse that you hear in the kitchen. They are very covetable, these pans here, because they take quite a while to make, and then it takes a few weeks for us to get them. So once we have them in the shop, we're very excited. We also think great gifts. There's a wonderful company up in San Francisco, and they actually have an outpost in Chicago now called Town Cutler. And they manufacture, along with knives, which is their main point of business, meat and cake testers. You know, it's a thin needle that you can use to test the doneness of a fish or a roast or a cake. But then it has a beautiful, like, nubby scrap of this artisanal wood that they use, the same wood they use for knife handles. So that's a really nice, a unique statement piece there. And then we also love the chef press, which is a stainless steel weight that's slotted. It fits in any saute pan. It's obviously great for like grilled cheese or bacon or anything, but I love it on using it on vegetables like mushrooms. Like, it gives them a nice dense texture.
Yeah, because what you're doing is you're compressing the cells of the product, and you're also making a ton of contact with the heat at the bottom of the pan.
Yeah, it just works so well with so many different things.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Evan.
That was Ken Concepcion, co-owner of LA's only cookbook store, now serving LA, which stocks many of the gifts we were just discussing. To learn more about the store, visit nowservingla.com. After the break, we're having the market report. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. Now we close out our show at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. Here's Jillian Ferguson.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. We are at the Pico Farmers Market this week on Pico and 23rd Street in Santa Monica, and I've just run into Melissa Perello. Melissa is, of course, the Michelin-decorated chef from Francis and Octavia restaurants up in San Francisco. And Melissa, you just opened M. Georgina in downtown LA. It's your first Los Angeles restaurant. So I have a feeling that you and I are here for the same reason today, which is to pick up some of these gorgeous chicories from County Line Harvest.
Yes.
Which ones do you have your eye on today?
Well, I'm really excited about the Puntarelle right now. We use it for salad, and we also sometimes will roast it or braise it as well.
Yeah, so let's describe what it is for people who haven't seen it. I always think it looks kind of like something from Little Shop of Horrors. It's a crazy looking chicory, meaning like a sort of bitter winter Italian green, right? And it has some tubes on the inside, and wrapped around the exterior are spindly leaves.
Yes.
How do you break that down?
Well, it's pretty simple. The prized element of the Puntarelle is the core. So those white little fingers that kind of stick out of the middle, and the larger and the more firm they are, the better, I feel. They're sometimes a little bit fibrous, and sometimes they have like large cores in the middle. But basically what you want to do is just remove or just simply like pull off the darker green leaves from the outside. They kind of look like dandelion greens and similar flavor as well. I like to take those and saute them, or cook them, or roast them, or braise them, mostly because that part is the most bitter of the plant. But you can also just simply like tear them up or chiffonade them and mix them into a salad as well. And then the core, you can either break it apart into like little finger-shaped pieces, or you can take the whole core and just simply shave it on a mandolin. And then you take those pieces and just soak it in iced cold water. I like to soak it for maybe like 45 minutes or so, and that kind of helps to extract some of the bitterness from the plant, and it also just crisps it up really nicely. And then just shake off all the water. And then the vinaigrette is really simple. It's just pulverized garlic or crushed garlic or simply chopped, mixed with some anchovy, olive oil, lemon, and you can always add a cheese like a pecorino or Parmesan is really delicious as well, and just simply toss everything together.
And that's the classic Roman preparation, as you
yes.
described it, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it sounds much more simple than it looks, because looking at this vegetable, I've always been a little bit intimidated by it. But now that we know how to cook it, it sounds delicious. What do you serve that with?
We actually just serve it with itself. Mm-hmm. We are taking them and actually quartering the whole plant and roasting them in the wood oven. And then finishing them with that, a very similar vinaigrette, like the salad, as well as just lemon, anchovy, garlic, and olive oil. And then we finish it with some breadcrumbs, basically.
Yum. And that wood oven does wonders to all vegetables.
Some, like,
right?
Really beautiful smokiness and
yeah.
great flavors.
Definitely. Awesome. Well, Melissa, thank you so much. I can't wait to come down and eat.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Melissa Perello. She is the chef owner of M. Georgina, which opened just a few weeks ago at The Row in downtown LA. The farmer behind the chicories that Melissa was just talking about is Megan Strom, who, along with David Retzky, is the co-owner of County Line Harvest, a farm that grows up in Petaluma as well as in Thermal down south, getting the best of both worlds. And Megan, the last time we spoke was in September, and I remember you saying that you had just put your winter greens in the ground, and now it's winter, they're here. That's how farming works. Tell us what you've got on the table this week in terms of your chicories.
Yeah, thank you. Welcome to Pico. Thanks for being here. We have our earliest chicories on the table. So we've got the Puntarella, the Palarosa, the Pandazucaro, Treviso, Rosa di Verona. And then we'll have in the next couple of weeks more of the speckleds coming on. So the Castelfranco and the Chioggia variegata are coming up soon. And then we have a spectacular chicory, which is very unique. It's brand new to us this year. Very difficult to find. We sourced the seed from Italy, and it's our Chicoria rosa.
Describe what it looks like.
It looks like a pink flower. Like, it's a nice dense head. The pink is coming out in several different shades. It's absolutely stunning, and I'm so pleased with how it turned out.
It really is beautiful, and I have to say, it looks like millennial pink chicory to me.
It's true. It's very Instagrammable.
Yes, yeah. Get your cameras ready, everybody. Talk to us a little bit about how you source this seed. You've told me before that it all comes from Italy. How did you go about finding it?
So we work with a company out of Kansas called Seeds from Italy. And my partner, David, started growing chicories up in Petaluma about 20 years ago. And so he has traveled to Northern Italy. He's gone to the chicory festivals. He's met with farmers. And he's worked really closely with Seeds from Italy to figure out just the best seed to go into our chicory mix. And the climate in Petaluma is a phenomenal place to grow chicories. It has really cool nights. It's in the coastal hills. It's really similar to Northern Italy. And so we get really nice, dense heads, and they are bitter, but they definitely have some sweetness to them.
And if people come to you and they're not used to bitter greens, how do you recommend that they start sort of approaching this category of greens?
Order a salad at a restaurant. That's what I do. But if you're going to make them at home, I like to eat them raw. I like to eat them in a salad, and I like to cut the bitterness with either like a sharp cheese or a sweet fruit. Persimmon is awesome as it starts to become available. Or you could even do like a blue cheese vinaigrette, something that's going to add in different flavors to get you used to the bitter.
And is there one variety in particular that you think is a good starter chicory?
I like to go with the greens. I find them less bitter. So the pan de zucchero, this pink chicory would be a great intro chicory. Castel Franco when it comes on. And then escarole. You know, we also have beautiful blanched escarole. And that's a really nice way to add some bitterness into your salad without the overwhelming taste of, say, like a Treviso or a Palarosa.
In terms of how these grow, do they grow similarly to lettuces? Do they require any really special care?
They're very similar to lettuce. So we plant them all as raw seed, which means that they take a lot of weeding. So we spend a lot of man hours caring for these chicories and getting them ready. We plant between July and October, and then they just sit. So as long as we get rain over the winter, they can deal with cold, they can deal with wet, and it's not really until you get the cold nights that you get that pop of color.
Awesome. Well, they look gorgeous, and I'm sure they're delicious too. Megan, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being here.
That was Megan Strom. Together with David Retzky, she co-owns County Line Harvest. You can find them at the Saturday Pico Market, Saturday Torrance, and also Sunday Mar Vista. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
That's it for our show this week. In case you missed any of it, as always, you can listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also find us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And as always, leave us a review if you liked what you heard. My thanks to the Good Food team, Nick Liao, Laurel Garcia, Joseph Stone, Chuck Previtary, and Ronnie Mickelson. Special thanks to Jacqueline Kim, Laura Kondarajan, and Amy Ta. I'm Evan Kleinman. I'll be back next week with more good food.